So how exactly does a 19th century legal debate over, the definition of the word domicile connect to the agonizing wait you just had in your airport security line?
Right, and the soaring price you're suddenly paying at the gas pump.
Exactly. I mean, on the surface, those things sound completely unrelated, but today we're going to find out exactly how they collide.
Yeah, it's an incredible web to untangle, but they are absolutely connected. What we're really looking at today is a fundamental, simultaneous reshaping of the rules of the road.
Like domestically, legally, and globally.
Right.
And we've got a massive stack of sources to guide us through this deep dive. We're looking at a hot off the press April 2026 Supreme Court transcript.
Oh, yeah, it's a dense one.
Very. Plus breaking news detailing some unprecedented internal turmoil within the US government and global oil market analyses that are just setting off alarm bells worldwide.
It's a lot to cover.
It is. But before we jump into the deep end, I do want to add a really quick caveat here. We're looking at some incredibly charged documents today, covering fiercely debated political ground from across the entire spectrum.
Yeah, I only charge.
So just to be completely clear up front, we aren't here to take a side, endorse a platform, or, tell you what to think. Our job is just to impartially map the terrain of this structural shift based entirely on the facts and the source material.
Exactly. Our goal is just to show you the blueprints of what's being built and what's being dismantled. We aren't here to tell you whether it's a good or bad architectural design.
Okay, so let's unpack this. We're going to start with the foundational blueprint of who even gets to be in the building. We have the transcript from the April 1st, 2026 Supreme Court oral arguments for a case called Trump v. Barbour,
Right.
and the entire debate centers on the 14th Amendment Citizenship Clause. Specifically, it's asking whether that clause guarantees birthright citizenship to the children of temporary visitors or illegal aliens.
Yeah, and the crux of this entire argument hinges on just five highly contested words from the 14th Amendment,
Sure.
subject to the jurisdiction thereof.
Okay.
So Solicitor General Jen Sauer is arguing for the petitioners, right? And he's pushing a core premise here. He says, historically, being subject to U.S. jurisdiction didn't just mean you had to obey local laws because you happened to be physically standing on American soil.
Right, like just being here isn't enough.
Exactly. He argues it meant you owed profound, permanent allegiance to the United States.
And allegiance isn't just like a feeling in this context. He's defining it through a very strict legal mechanism, right?
He is. Sauer argues that allegiance is established by domicile.
Domicile.
Yeah, and in legal terms, domicile means lawful presence combined with an intent to remain permanently. He's pointing out that the 14th Amendment, which was adopted right after the Civil War to grant citizenship to newly freed slaves, was designed for people whose allegiance was established by generations of domicile.
Oh, I see.
According to his argument, it was never meant to grant automatic citizenship to the children of temporary visitors or undocumented immigrants because they haven't established that authorized permanent allegiance.
Okay, so wait. If I'm hearing this right, the analogy here is kind of like a country club membership.
Okay, yeah.
You're saying the argument isn't about simply being born inside the clubhouse walls. It's about whether your parents were holding an authorized permanent membership card at the exact moment you were born.
That is exactly the framework the Solicitor General is using to build his case.
Mm.
And to back up that interpretation, he reaches way back to the Civil Rights Act of 1866.
So pre-14th Amendment.
Right. He points out that Congress initially used the phrase, not subject to any foreign power, before they eventually settled on subject to the jurisdiction thereof.
That's a huge distinction.
It is. And he quotes Senator Trumbull, who was a key framer of the amendment, who explicitly explained that the phrase means not owing allegiance to anybody else. Sauer's goal is to prove that the framers were actively, intentionally rejecting the old British common law concept.
Which was what exactly?
The idea that simply being born in the king's land made you the king's subject forever.
Okay, but wait, I have to push back here. And this actually echoes a really sharp line of questioning from Justice Gorsuch in the transcript.
Right. Gorsuch went right after this.
He did. How can you take an 1868 understanding of domicile or lawful presence and cleanly map it onto today's world? I mean, modern, highly restrictive immigration laws, visas, border checkpoints, those didn't even exist back in 1868.
They really didn't.
If you showed up on a boat back then and intended to stay, you were essentially domiciled. So how can you tie constitutional originalism to a massive bureaucratic immigration framework that was invented decades later?
That is the exact friction point Justice Gorsuch zeroes in on. It's, frankly, the most vulnerable part of the historical argument. Gorsuch essentially asks, if we are rigidly applying the 1868 definition of domicile, wouldn't the modern concept of being an illegal alien be completely immaterial?
Because it didn't exist.
Exactly. Because back then, the legal category of an illegal alien simply didn't exist in the way we understand it now.
It seems like you're trying to run, like, modern software on a 19th century operating system. So how does Sauer counter that?
Well, Sauer counters by arguing that the broad principle was established back then, the principle being that jurisdiction requires lawful domicile.
Okay.
He argues it's perfectly natural for Congress to later pass specific laws defining who does and doesn't have the legal capacity to establish that domicile. In his view, there's zero historical evidence that the framers intended to strip Congress of the power to dictate who can legally be in the country.
Which brings us to the giant elephant in the room regarding precedent. Because anyone who has studied immigration law knows the 1898 case, Wong Kim Ark.
Oh, absolutely. The bedrock case.
Right. Opponents of Sauer's view point to this ruling as the absolute foundation for unrestricted birthright citizenship in America.
Yes. Wong Kim Ark is the cornerstone of the opposition here. The respondents, represented by Cecilia Wang, along with several justices like Kagan and Sotomayor, point out that for well over a century, this case has been universally understood to mean that the U.S. adopted the common law tradition of jus soli.
And jus soli meaning?
Meaning citizenship is granted by the geography of your birth, literally, right of the soil.
Right.
But Sauer takes a really aggressive legal swing here.
Mm.
He doesn't just dismiss Wong Kim Ark, he actively reinterprets it.
Wait, really? How?
He argues the ruling actually supports his domicile requirement because the parents of the child in that specific 1898 case were lawfully and permanently domiciled in the U.S., even though the racist laws at the time prevented them from naturalizing.
Wow. Okay. So he's basically threading the needle. He's saying, yes, Wong Kim Ark is good law, but it only applies if you are legally allowed to be here.
Exactly.
And he brings in modern geopolitical issues to justify why this aggressive reinterpretation is necessary right now. I know he specifically brings up the concept of birth tourism.
He does. He's trying to show the court the practical, modern consequences of maintaining the status quo. He cites reports detailing over 500 birth tourism companies operating in China alone.
500?
Yeah, just in China. His argument is that unrestricted birthright citizenship operates as a massive structural pull factor. He says it rewards those who bypass the system and actively undermines the people waiting in line following the rules.
So when you step back from all the legal jargon, what we're looking at is a profound attempt to shift the very baseline of American identity. If the court agrees with this, citizenship moves away from the absolute certainty of physical geography and becomes strictly tethered to authorized intent and congressional statutes.
It completely redefines the boundaries of the American political community.
And that redefinition isn't happening in a vacuum. The theoretical battle over who belongs here is directly fueling a catastrophic breakdown in the real-world systems designed to police those borders.
It's spilling right over into reality.
Yeah. Which brings us out of the marble halls of the Supreme Court and right into the harsh reality of everyday government operations. Because right now, the machinery tasked with enforcing the border is caught in a massive stalemate.
Mm.
We're currently staring down a 41-day funding shutdown for the Department of Homeland Security.
And look, 41 days is an eternity in government funding.
It really is.
And it's driven entirely by an ideological standoff over how immigration enforcement should actually look on the ground. The Democrats are refusing to pass the DHS funding bill because they're demanding strict operational changes.
Like what kind of changes?
They want ICE officers to be required to wear IDs. They want them to remove facial masks. And they're demanding a halt to raids near sensitive locations like schools and churches.
But the Republicans are holding the line on that. And the reason they can afford to hold the line without blinking is because of, like, a structural funding quirk, right?
Exactly. They don't actually need this specific DHS funding bill to keep immigration enforcement up and running.
Wait, really? Why not?
Because they're defending a $75 billion funding pipeline for ICE that was already baked into a previous completely separate tax bill.
Oh, wow.
So you have this bizarre asymmetrical shutdown where ICE and other core immigration officers are fully funded and operating normally, while the rest of the Homeland Security apparatus is completely starving.
It creates a totally bifurcated system, and the human toll of that starvation is just staggering. This connects right back to that airport security line you mentioned at the top of the show.
Right, the TSA.
Yeah, because the TSA falls under DHS. Those agents are currently facing their second completely missed paycheck.
And it's brutal. According to the acting TSA administrator, these unpaid workers aren't just inconvenienced. They're facing eviction notices.
Right.
Their bills are piling up. Some are even resorting to donating plasma just to put food on the table.
While still being expected to show up and secure the nation's airports.
Exactly. This is where we see the mechanism of systemic collapse in real time. Critical infrastructure ultimately relies on the fragile social contract of a biweekly paycheck. When you break that contract, the infrastructure literally begins to disintegrate.
And the data reflects this instantly, doesn't it?
It does. Multiple major airports are now seeing TSA callout rates of over 40%.
Almost half the staff.
Yeah. Nearly 500 agents have outright quit. And perhaps most alarmingly, the friction of this breakdown is causing assaults on TSA agents by frustrated travelers to spike by an unbelievable 500%.
Wow. 500%. It's just pure chaos. You have a critical security apparatus crumbling. So how is the president responding to this?
Well, Trump is threatening to bypass the legislative stalemate entirely. He stated he will sign an executive order or potentially declare a national emergency.
To do what, exactly?
To instruct the Homeland Security Secretary to immediately pay TSA agents using funds shifted from other departments.
Yeah.
Which is a highly aggressive maneuver. It essentially sidesteps the constitutional power of the purse, which is traditionally held exclusively by Congress.
Right. It's a massive escalation.
But what's truly fascinating is the contrast here. While the machinery of basic, everyday government services is grinding to a halt over funding, the machinery at the absolute top of the executive branch is being overhauled at breakneck speed.
Oh, absolutely.
Right. While TSA agents are literally selling their blood plasma to survive, the Department of Justice is undergoing a massive, immediate shakeup. Breaking news from our sources indicates President Trump has just ousted his attorney general, Pam Bondi.
Yeah, and the rationale behind her departure tells us exactly what the administration values right now.
What happened?
Reports indicate the president grew increasingly frustrated with Bondi's handling of the Jeffrey Epstein files. Specifically, a perceived lack of transparency that his political allies were demanding.
Okay, so pressure from the base.
Exactly. And beyond that, there was reported frustration over the slow pace of politically sensitive prosecutions.
So she's out. And who is stepping in as acting attorney general? Todd Blanche. This is his former personal defense attorney and a fiercely loyal ally.
Yeah, Blanche was already positioned as the 40th deputy attorney general, but elevating him to the top spot signals a very clear prime directive from the executive branch.
Which is what?
Well, in a moment of intense political friction, conventional legislative compromise is viewed as a liability. The administration is demanding absolute alignment with its legal and political instincts at the helm of the nation's top law enforcement agency.
So what does this all mean for you, the listener? I mean, if you're looking at this from the outside, it feels like the government engine is running on two completely contradictory gears.
That's a great way to put it.
On one hand, it's totally stalled out on basic funding for everyday security, leaving airports in a state of dangerous chaos. But on the other hand, it's operating with ruthless efficiency to swap out the top mechanic, the attorney general, to ensure maximum political loyalty at the highest levels.
Right. It's a stark portrait of a system under immense stress, shifting power away from deadlocked congressional processes and centralizing it within unilateral executive action.
And that executive centralization isn't just an internal American story. Because while the U.S. is internally paralyzed over borders and loyalty, its executive actions abroad are triggering massive global economic ripples.
Yes, the global stage.
This America First approach to domestic policy is now playing out internationally, specifically in Iran.
The situation in the Middle East has escalated to a critical boiling point. President Trump is currently weighing whether to fold or double down on the U.S. military involvement in Iran. He has publicly claimed that the U.S. has achieved full regime change and that the hard part of the conflict is over.
But here is the twist that is sending shockwaves through the global market. He is suggesting the U.S. might unilaterally withdraw its forces without reopening the Strait of Hormuz. His message to international allies who are heavily dependent on oil from the Persian Gulf was incredibly blunt. He posted on Truth Social, telling countries like the UK to either buy oil directly from the US or, quote, get your own oil.
And to understand the gravity of that threat, we really have to look at the physical reality on the water. The Strait of Hormuz isn't just a waterway. It is arguably the most critical maritime choke point on the planet.
It's the bottleneck for so much of the world's energy.
Exactly. And right now, Iran has effectively closed it. They've passed laws demanding tolls be paid in local currency, they're requiring extensive detailed information from ships, and they are formalizing a literal blockade. Right now, only about 12 ships are passing through a day.
Just 12.
Yeah, and most of them have direct links to Iran.
It is incredibly dangerous out there. Our sources note that an Indian crude tanker, the Jagla Dotki, just barely escaped a drone attack while trying to load cargo at the UAE's Fujairah port. This isn't a theoretical closure on paper. It is an active hot war zone.
It is. And how are U.S. allies responding to Trump's demand that they step up and secure these waters themselves?
I'm guessing not well.
They are bulking.
Yeah.
Germany's defense minister, Boris Pistorius, stated flatly, "This is not our war."
Wow.
The German chancellor spokesperson doubled down, adding that it's not NATO's war either. Yeah. Spain similarly refused to send ships to join a military mission. The European Union is completely divided over military action and is just scrambling to find some sort of diplomatic or logistical miracle to bypass the blockade.
And while the politicians argue over who should send ships, the markets are in a state of absolute panic. Let's talk about the economic mechanism here, because this is exactly where your gas pump comes in.
Yeah, the real-world impact.
Brent crude, which is the global benchmark for oil prices, just hit $116.80 a barrel. And analysts are terrified this is just the floor.
They have every right to be. Organizations like Macquarie Group are warning that if this closure in the Strait is prolonged, we could see oil hit an astronomical $150 to $200 a barrel.
But wait, if the Middle East is bottlenecked, my first instinct is that the market will just reroute. I mean, surely there are alternative pipelines or other major oil-producing nations that can step up and fill the gap to stabilize the price.
They are desperately trying, but the alternative infrastructure is buckling under the pressure. Saudi Arabia has tried to reroute its crude flows to the Yanbu pipeline on the Red Sea.
Okay, so why doesn't that work?
The problem is, that pipeline is now pushing its absolute operational ceiling at 4.6 million barrels a day. The physical system is straining, which causes massive logistical delays and spikes freight costs across the board.
Okay, well, what about Russian oil? They are a massive producer. Can't they flood the market?
That's the other half of this perfect storm. Ukrainian drone strikes have severely crippled Russian oil ports in the Baltic Sea, specifically critical infrastructure like Ust-Luga and Primorsk.
Oh, I see.
At least 40% of Russia's oil export capacity has been brought to a dead halt. So you have the Middle East locked down by a blockade and Russia's output slashed simultaneously by drone warfare. The supply simply isn't there to replace what's trapped in the Gulf.
Here's where it gets really interesting. I have to push back on the viability of this new U.S. strategy, the whole get your own oil concept.
Okay, hear it.
If the U.S. unilaterally leaves the Middle East and tells its allies, fend for yourselves, protect your own shipping lanes, doesn't that fundamentally rewrite the rules of global trade? It feels like pulling the keystone out of a massive stone arch and telling the other stones to just hold themselves up.
Right.
When that arch collapses, it doesn't just crush the stones, it crushes the market underneath it. Even if the U.S. produces its own oil domestically, how does this strategy not eventually crush you and me at the gas pump?
Your keystone analogy is absolutely perfect for understanding this. The entire interconnected global trade system, pretty much since the end of World War II, has relied on the implicit assumption of U.S. naval protection over vital maritime choke points.
Right. The U.S. Navy patrols the trade routes.
Exactly. By abruptly shifting that burden, the physical supply chain fractures. Now, to your point about the U.S. producing its own oil, it's true the U.S. has limited physical exposure to Persian Gulf crude, but oil is a fungible commodity priced on a global market.
So it doesn't matter where it comes from.
Right. If global supply suddenly drops by the millions of barrels that are currently locked behind the Strait of Hormuz, the price for every single barrel on Earth skyrockets, regardless of where it was pumped out of the ground.
So the idea that getting our own oil insulates the U.S. consumer from $200 a barrel crude is essentially an illusion.
Exactly. It drives up massive, unavoidable inflation domestically. But geopolitically, the implications are even more severe. It forces countries to rapidly rethink their global alliances.
Because they have to survive.
Yes. If Europe and Asia feel they can no longer rely on the U.S. security umbrella to keep their economies running, they are left with terrible choices. They might have to acquiesce to Iranian extortion to get their energy, or, as several analysts are warning, They may strengthen economic and military ties with U.S. adversaries like Russia and China just to secure their basic energy needs.
Wow. Okay, let's bring it all together. Today, we've traced a massive simultaneous renegotiation of American power and structure happening on multiple fronts at the exact same time.
We truly have. We've looked at the very foundations of the system being tested.
We started with the microscopic, linguistic parsing of a 19th century word domicile at the Supreme Court, exploring a legal theory that aims to fundamentally redefine who gets to be an American citizen and shift the baseline from geography to intent.
Right.
Then we moved to the very tangible impacts of a paralyzed domestic security force. We saw the mechanics of infrastructure collapse with TSA agents pushed to the brink of eviction, while the executive branch aggressively centralized power by shaking up the top of the DOJ for maximum loyalty.
And we ended on the macroeconomic shockwaves of a closed Strait of Hormuz, exploring how the withdrawal of the American military keystone is threatening to send global inflation into the stratosphere and force a realignment of global alliances.
So why does all of this matter to you? Because executive and legal decisions are, right now, rewriting the foundational rules of your world. They're deciding the legal definition of who gets to be your neighbor, determining how long you wait in a chaotic line at the airport, and dictating exactly how much it costs to fill your gas tank on the way home.
Which leaves us with a final provocative thought to mull over. We've seen how fragile these systems are. What happens to a society when the foundational agreements of the last century are all rewritten at the exact same time?
Yeah.
From the 14th Amendment's meaning to the funding mechanisms of basic domestic security to the unwritten promise of global trade protection, can a system survive when every single rule is suddenly up for negotiation?
It's a heavy question, and it really brings us right back to where we started. The distance between a dusty legal dictionary defining domicile in 1868 and the digital numbers spinning wildly out of control on your local gas pump isn't actually that far.
Not at all.
They are just different gears in the exact same machine, and right now someone is trying to rebuild that machine while the engine is still running. Thanks for taking this deep dive with us.